calls me Eddie Spaghetti. Don't ask.
You know,
he's American.
American. You know, anything to get a rise out of you. All right, welcome to What Are You Guys Talking About?
What are you guys talking about?
All right, well, we've been gabbing for about 30 minutes already, man. That's pretty cool. But we are here on another episode of What Are You Guys Talking About? I think it's episode 75. Kind of proud of that.
Yes,
here with
nice
the
number.
Great, the legendary, the I don't know. You
may oh God,
I've never been called that before.
Really cool. It was legendary.
I mean, the legendary ninja, like just coming out of nowhere with the huge movies and stuff.
Yeah, I mean that gets us every time because you know that's the thing about this show, right, Richard? We're like. We're film geeks as well. Like, this is why we did Kill Bill like 2 weeks ago. And it was just affirming to us just what absolute film geeks we are. Like,
but yeah. to me, it was incredible that we met at South End, didn't we? Like South End.
Yeah.
Screams on South End. I can't watch the name of the festival.
Horror on Sea.
Thank you. Yes.
Who's the guy that does the, I remember the promoter for that. He was the nicest guy in the world. He like came out, shook my hand. Like,
yeah, like quite dapperly like dressed.
Yeah, so I think Paul Cotgrave, I think his name is. Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, and he just doesn't know for me. Like I show up to these things once in a while and like just happy my name's on the bill.
Well,
take a seat, bro, you know?
No, for me, what was really cool was like, I, you know, I'd done a lot of film festivals in Asia and stuff when I lived out there, but like, I'd never been somewhere where like I spoke the language, you know, and I could just hang in a bar and talk to someone and everyone was just so nice and so into like just being there. And I love film festivals for that reason, I think.
Yeah, I think that one's a particularly nice one, actually. It's and I think they broke into the Movie Maker magazine top 25 genre festivals in the world this year.
Nice.
It, you know, it's,
shout out Horror on
Sea. Yeah, it's a really good festival because you go to some of them, the genre festivals, and they're kind of a bit snobby in terms of the kind of groups of people, you know, who are running them sometimes, or the groups of audience members. And you go to Horror on Sea and it's so relaxed, and you know, everybody kind of assembles in that bar and everybody just talks to everybody. It was a really refreshing experience. Although I think my cast and crew commandeered the pool table for like the entire day on the Saturday. We were playing pool and drinking in the bar from about 10 in the morning through to about 10 at night.
Oh, you were those guys. You were those
yeah,
guys.
That was us.
Yeah, no, as I said, if I remember correctly, you were sitting there with Mal Jutley, who's always part of the crew too.
Yeah.
Talking to you as well. And we were there with the guy who we did Shredders with, because that's what we showed at South.
Mike.
Yeah.
That was Michael James Dean, who we work with. Actually, not too far from where your alma mater is. He's out in Kent in Faversham.
Yeah, I went to Kent University as well. What years were you there?
1999 to 2002.
Mate, we were there at the same goddamn time. I was there from 2000 to 2003.
Would you want to hear something that made me feel really old? There's a new guy started in the office at work, and I was chatting to him, and he was like, "Oh, I went to the University of Kent." I was like, "Oh, so did I." I was like, "When were you there?" He was like, "Oh, I've just finished." I was like, "When were you born?" He said, 1999. I was like, I started that year.
But before we get too much into it, we need to officially introduce our guest, because, you know, we're now getting into stories. So, Mr. Richard Rowntree, thank you so much for joining us here on What Are You Guys Talking About?
Oh, hello. Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
That's why I let Ed do it, because I would have said Richard Rowntree, because I'm American and I can't pronounce
Rowntree.
You've got to give it a little bit of that.
Have you ever seen Sexy Beast?
Yes.
Rowntree, like the sweets. Grosvenor, yes, Rowntree.
That is one of my favorite performances of all time.
It's a really good
Ben
movie.
Kingsley. Oh my God, so good.
Yeah.
So good. Anyway, that's where we met. But your journey into the film biz started way back when.
Way back. So
you jump into it, I kind of want to know what was the seed that was planted? Was it like a particular film? Was it like you know, doing plays? Was it like you mentioned growing up near Pinewood before we got a mic? Was it that got you thinking about movies as a career and stuff like that?
Yeah, so there's kind of two things, and it's like right back at the start of the journey. So I grew up, and it was just my mum and I when I was growing up, and she worked loads to support us, and so I would be sat down in front of videos very often as a kid, and there was a local video store that was about a mile from us, and it was called Take Two Video. It was like proper mom and pop, and you know, plastered on the walls with kind of Nightmare on Elm Street posters and things like that. And so she would take me in there on a Saturday morning, and I think you used to get three videos for the weekend or whatever, and you could keep them, you know, till the Sunday evening. And she basically did not care what I watched. She was just like, whatever. And
so just like my mom.
Yeah, I think I progressed really rapidly from, you know, the Disney kind of animated Jungle Book to RoboCop.
Oh my god!
Like really quickly. And you know, there were still kind of family movies in there, but
Of course,
you want the ones with the exciting posters when you're like seven, right? So, but anyway, so I used to watch, you know, it was a big thing as well, obviously, like BBC, like at 10 o'clock or 10:30, they would show a movie after the news quite often. Mm-hmm. And so I was into things like, you know, Jaws and you know, watching things like that. And so when I was I don't remember if I was six or seven, but I saw The Shining. And I was just utterly mesmerized by it. Like, obviously, looking back now, I had no idea really what was going on in it. But even on the surface of it, the kind of sense of the uncanny and the unsettling nature of it really took me in. And so going back a bit further, so my mum was a florist as her trade, and she did quite a lot of work on movies at Pinewood Studios, which was near where we lived. And so she would tell me these stories about having been on set and things, and she did a couple of Bond movies and things like that, which was really
God, that must have been amazing, because that's a national treasure.
Yeah, and you watch those movies when you're a kid again, like
Christmas time, man.
Don't really know what's going on, but yeah, and so that combined with the fact that, you know, all of the kind of men in the village worked there as sort of carpenters and riggers and prop makers and stuff. Just, you know, everything seemed to be drawing me in from a really early age into wanting to do it. And so I think the first time I helped out on a set was when I was 13. Mm-hmm. And it was, there was in the village again, like there's loads of kind of, not celebrities, this is the wrong word, but like people who have worked in the industry over the years.
Yeah.
And so there's this guy whose stage name is Richard Martin, who was one of the original directors of the first series of Doctor Who.
Oh, wow.
And
holy crap, that is some celebrity.
And so he's married, I forget what his wife's stage name is now, but anyway, she'd been an actress as well and had been kind of quite big in the early 60s in TV stuff. And he was a teacher by that point at Mountview Theatre School, and he had a little studio in his back garden, and he used to bring students there for the weekend so that they could practice and whatever else. And so I started off kind of going along there and helping out with bits and pieces like that, and progressed by the time I was like 16-17 to just helping out on any shoots that I could find anywhere. But it was still kind of pre-internet back then, so it was like through people we knew.
Did you get the chance to work with film?
Not actual film, not at that stage. No, I mean, it was kind of really basic, kind of almost handycam type,
like, you know, mini stuff. DV stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Do you remember when the Panasonic DVX-100 came out, the one that did 24 frames per second?
I'm so weird. Like, I'm somebody who is so obsessed with film and who's been so obsessed with wanting to work in film. I have zero interest in cameras whatsoever.
Really? Okay, that's cool.
One for our side.
I'm like, I know what I want. And I know it can be achieved, but I leave all of that to the experts. In the same way that the lighting, I leave to the experts. And
see, that is a golden nugget of advice for, you know, our filmmaking audience out there, because, you know, we do try and give a little bit of you know, knowledge or share whatever we can. But that is a really, really good nugget.
I don't know what I'm doing.
No, that you trust the people that you choose for the job, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
it's a really important point. And it's something, this is where I try to meld, you know, I don't know if I've ever given you my background, Richard, but you know, I've worked for 10 years, 12 years, really, as kind of like a lawyer / insurance consultant. Like, I'm just someone who's good with that type of stuff. But yeah, I work as like a project manager now. And the first mistake you make as a lawyer becoming a project manager is that you try to think that if someone else can't do it, you're just going to do it yourself. And when I was a junior, that was my life. So it was 18-hour days, 20-hour days, making up for the fact that I asked people to do things that were not impossible, but were very difficult, and they wouldn't deliver. And I started realizing that, A, no one was developing on my teams. You know what I mean? They were all just coming back to me when they had a big problem.
Yeah. But
B, like, I just was never going to get, I couldn't work like that the rest of my life. Like, I'd die, a heart attack, you know? So you have to learn to start trusting experts. And it's been hard for me in film because it's like, what's indie, right? We all do it ourselves. But this is what we were talking to you earlier about production design. Like, I was never the art guy. You know what I mean? Like, and there are some things, like when it comes to cameras, I've learned a little, like I've read a book. So I know, and I have a Panasonic GX80. So I'm like one step a little bit further than you that I can kind of figure out what I'm doing with it. And then I call Ed and say, like, Ed, I have no idea what I'm doing with the rest of this. What can we do?
I'm like his Google for cameras.
Yeah. you're the camera guy. And even when we formed this business, we had to set it up so that we could do different things, but we didn't, like, it's not that we don't cross over in each other's space. We just respect the fact that
we don't cross the
certain
streams.
Things that you're really good with and certain things I'm really good with. And we need to let those people do those things because otherwise everything slows down.
That is a really important thing about indie film. Absolutely. It's, and you know, when you're trying to direct as well, you know, don't get me wrong, I've got a million hats on. I go in and sort out the catering, you know, and I do, you know, I clean up the set at the end of the day when everyone's gone home.
Amen.
And in COVID times, I bleach the bathrooms at the end of the day, you know, and, you know, there are things that I can do, but I don't have the space in the memory palace to take on. I, you know, like you, I've picked up a little bit of kind of camera stuff along the way, but I can't get into that zone of, and it's same with sound. I just, you know, I don't have the time to sit there and do a 7-minute tutorial to learn how to do the sound.
You said that because on this one that we were talking about, you reap what you sow. I have a buddy, you probably know him, Mitch Bain. You might've run across his name. He's a composer. He's been on the show before.
I know the name. Yeah.
So, and I was just like, oh, yeah, have him do sound. Like, I'll talk him into it because I know he's got a mixer and I'll just get on the phone with him. And this is what I'm like. Like, I will just talk him into being my head of department for this. And then I read, I'm always reading because I'm not able to go to film school. So it's like, well, I got to learn somehow. And I was reading this production book called Producer to Producer. And they just listed out, it was only a checklist, but a checklist like of all the things you have to make sure the sound person knows, you know? And it was like, he won't know any of that. Not because he's not a good guy. And not because he's not good with it, but he's never done half the stuff on that list. I know because I've talked to him before. So it's not fair for me to say, oh, by the way, could you just learn these 15 things that need to be done absolutely as best as you can? Like, that's just not a fair ask. Again, going back to the project manager thing, that's setting him up for failure. So it's like, I've got to find out, I've got to go out there and I can have him compose the music and can have him help with that. But I've got to find somebody out there that can do the boom mic and can do the rest of the stuff and knows exactly what they're doing with that. So
even the difference between like a mixer and a on-set sound recordist, you know, like I've done sound recording. I've been a boom operator, you know, but I know that sound mixing is a whole other world, you know. But I also think that, you know, and this is kind of what you were saying a little bit earlier, that, you know, if you can find people who have like the energy and the enthusiasm and you can help them together, like to you know, improve and get better. And that's what you were saying, Jay, as well, about, you know, like bringing people up as well. You know, like, I think that's also really important. Whenever I've had like really young people, you know, who are just a runner or whatever, you know, and they want to know about aperture or like, what does that mean? Why do they do that? Like, you know, I'm always like happy to share the love, so to speak.
This is the thing. Like, I don't work in the industry. I haven't. It's a bummer. I'd love to. So if anyone out there wants to offer me a job, go ahead. But when I've come into horror from Fright Fest, from hanging out with a bunch of filmmakers for a long time that were film fans. The whole reason everybody likes Fright Fest is they're the nicest people in the world. You can walk around, talk to everybody. But then when I started producing, you know, my first question was, because we were talking about this before the podcast, is why isn't there a UK studio? We have Pinewood. We got Shepperton. We got all this money trucking its way all the way back over to California, which I've been there. I used to live there. Like, cool. But why are we sending all that money back? Like, we have some really talented people here. And what I found out is because we didn't have this culture of bringing people up going on. Like, people were very close-knit about what they would share at first. And then it was like, well, that person might take my idea. And it was like, you've got to get away from all this. You know what I mean?
You really have. There's and Jason Tostevin, he runs Nightmares Film Festival in Ohio. You know, it's like,
Columbus. That's where I went to college, Ohio State. So yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it's like one of the biggest horror festivals in the world, right? And he runs it, and he imparts this knowledge, which is so valuable. And I wish so many more people would listen to it, is that when you're a filmmaker, you're not in competition with other filmmakers or anybody else, right? It's not if somebody else wins an award that you're nominated for, you need to concentrate on being grateful for being in the festival in the first place, not dragging other people down. And this whole thing is kind of, and I don't think it's just in horror. I think it's just filmmaking in general. Unfortunately, there's this kind of clambering to even get on the ladder, let alone get up the ladder. And people think that, you know, oh, if the BFI is funding their film, then it means they're not funding my film. That's not true. If they're funding their film and they're not funding your film, it's because their film's better than your film.
There you go.
But that's not, you know, so you got to up your game, you know, be concerned about that. It is a bizarre thing, but yeah.
It's tough. I mean, going through those first couple of years of production where we were submitting for people I thought were some of the most talented filmmakers, at least for their age, that I've been working with and ever seen. You know, I didn't know much, but then you'd find out that you didn't have a producer that the BFI liked, and all of a sudden you weren't going to even come close to getting that funding. You know what I mean? It wasn't even worth doing the application. And so I get why it happens. You know, it's not easy like it would be in Europe to get access to state funds here. You know what I mean? And that means you've got to go to private investors and try to say, I've got a really good idea. And most of them are going to say, like, absolutely not. So I get it. It's just, I think my overall philosophy, which seems to marry with yours a lot, is if we all help each other out, then it will be a lot less of a problem. Like, then you'll be able to pick up the phone and say, hey, I need help with this. And we'll all be like, that's how we've tried to be with you, is be like, if you need us for anything, we just love being on set, man. So
exactly. You know, sandwich, runners, teammate. I'm there. Whatever.
All of our friends have always been the same way. You know what I mean? It's like, and Ed can tell you a story. He comes from, I used to call it the hippie commune, but he lived in Korea as part of like a film commune out there. And they got things done that way. And I just think, man, there's so much talent in the UK, so much talent. It's crazy. You know, I see it in the horror because that's what I love, but you know, it's everywhere. And if we could just get it together, which people are trying, you know what I mean? Then it's going to be a really amazing thing just to see some of that come back to England.
It does feel like the indie horror is primed in the UK for that kind of thing. There's just so much innovation and like thinking outside the box. And I mean, you know, we were lucky enough to talk to Richard Oakes and Adam Leader, who co-directed Hosts as well. And, you know, getting to talk to you after having watched Nefarious. And I really, really want to devote some time to that because I need to know things. but just the kind of, you know, vibing with people. And that's the thing that I've been enjoying the most. You know, we've been working quite hard to network, you know, but of course that means in the time of Corona, like, hey, do you want to jump on a Zoom? Do you want to do a podcast? Do you want to, you know, do stuff like that? And it feels like there's, you know, things are primed for.
Nobody's had the famous brunch yet, Ed. This is ridiculous. I'm the guy with the Amex that will buy just about fucking anyone brunch. Like, you know, it's my thing. And I haven't been able to give anyone brunch. I keep sending emails out to people being like, it's okay, it's COVID, but we can still have brunch. We have brunch.
Brunch in the garden.
I think in the UK indie horror world, there certainly is a group of people, which I'd like to count myself amongst, who are very supportive of each other, who do, you know, go to festivals, and people like Scott Lyers and Elliot Maguire and Charlie Steeds and all these guys. You know, I've never seen any of us talking disparagingly about anybody else's work. You know, on a social level, we all get on. We do see each other.
That's the thing. So welcoming as well, though, man. Because you know, I'm not like Jason. I wasn't in the sleepy queue. I haven't like been in the trenches of, you know, Fright Fest family.
You is like we were doing, you know, one of my favorite events at Fright Fest is always the karaoke because we all get hammered and sing. Logan gets out there and he's very theatrical. So he does something really big. And, you know, Andy Stewart, who no one ever remembers, has a really good voice, comes out there and sings Elvis. And they're like, holy shit. You know what I mean? But for Ed, a lot of them didn't know Ed, but there's this part in the back of where we go and it's really crowded, really hot. And we just wanted somewhere to chill because we'd been out, you know, buying burgers to people, networking, doing the whole thing. And they gave us a spot in the back, like, because we'd been like,
everybody so nice
out and just like took care of it was just the coolest thing. Like, no one had ever met Ed before, but I was like, he's with me, guys. Like, and it's real important. We've had a long day.
Very welcoming, you know?
Couldn't believe it. Like, you know what I mean? People hadn't even met him. Like, dude, yeah, come chill. You know what I mean? It was.
And that's kind of why it does surprise me in some ways that there isn't more of that kind of community feel. But I did want to jump into how you go from, okay, I'm doing some jobs on this film, on that film, to like, okay, fuck all of you, I know what's up, I'm gonna start directing and I don't need your money, like I don't need shit, like I'm doing it my way. Like, at what point do you get there?
I'd been writing screenplays kind of since I was at university, and doing then day jobs in the industry to kind of pay the bills, and kind of thought that at some point my chance would come without me having to go and find it. You know, it would just come to me. And I think when, sorry, my wife,
did you do,
when did we do the first film? It was like 2006. It was just after Grace was born, the first one.
No. 2013.
2013. There we go. 2013. My mind's
What do married people? At what point do married people, married men, like lose track of time and need their spouse for?
Oh, I think, just be quiet.
For me, it was pretty early. Kids.
Is that early?
Because I'm horrible with it, Ed. You know that.
But no, she's my social diary and calendar. And
I guess that's
like production diary. And he has to, like, I'm the one who have it on the calendar, but Becky will know what day it is, and I won't.
Yeah,
but I think that kind of by that point, it was like the means of doing it had become more affordable.
Okay,
with a Blackmagic camera and what have you, and I knew enough people from having worked for such a long time with them that I was in a position where I was like, look. Here's the, and I suppose it was a bit different. So the first one we ever did was for a 48-hour competition.
Gotcha.
So we were in a position where we could be like, look, give up 48 hours of your time. And we know at the end of that 48 hours, we will have a finished film. We don't know how good it will be.
How did it turn out? Because I've done twice. The first time I had to bow out because I got the fucking swine flu, and the second time was an incredible experience, but one I would never wish to repeat.
I think we've done it three times now, and I've done
insane.
So the first time I did it, we had a crew of like 20 people, and we built in the time like a 36-foot by 14-foot set with four rooms in it. And it was the interior of a spaceship, and it was like all LED lights and kind of vac form panels that I managed to blag for free. And the movie wasn't very good. And then the second time we did it was kind of, let's spend less time on making it look amazing and more time on the script. And it was kind of okay. I think we got into the top 10 though, which was quite cool. Mm-hmm. And then the last time I did it, I was in Jordan working on a movie.
Okay.
And I said to my translator, I've got this idea. There's this thing called a 48-hour competition. We've got to work on the first day, so it'll actually be a 24-hour competition. And there was two of us in the desert. Let's just do it. Let's just shoot it on an iPhone and go back to the hotel and edit it. And again, we finished in the top 10, and it's probably the best movie of the lot.
So okay, let's unpack that. There's a lot there. Yeah. So first of all, you've done it three times. On the third go, you were working for the first 24 hours, and you're like, you know what? Not that it's already a like hard fucking thing to do. let's make it a little bit harder. And let's just do it in 24 hours. And I'll put some more into that as well. Okay,
so,
go on.
So the plan was that my translator guy, Abed, he was lovely. He'd been trying to convince me. We were shooting in Wadi Rum, which is where they did Rogue One and movies like that. And so the Aqaba is like an hour away in the car. And he'd been saying to me for ages, like, do you know what? Like, we should stay out in the desert one night, just sleep out. And I was like, what, in a tent? He was like, no, just like get some blankets and just sleep in the desert. He's like, it's amazing. And I'd been putting it off and putting it off. And I'd agreed that on this Saturday, after we'd finished filming out there, I was like, yeah, okay, we'll do it then. And so we had our stuff with us for overnight. And it was this weekend of the competition. And so we had a few beers in the desert and slept out under the stars and woke up on the Sunday morning and then went and shot it for about 3 hours and then went back to the hotel and edited it all and uploaded it.
That's amazing. The one that you build a set for and you do all this shit doesn't work out. The one that you're fucking virtually hungover.
Yeah.
And you've said, yeah, I guess we'll do it.
Let's just do it.
It's probably the best one. That's amazing.
So that's
inspiration. That's,
you know, I always go back to it, but that's the dandelion scene. That was that damn situation where we had the best freaking shot in this little short that we did.
Yeah.
And it was me trailing my daughter leaving the forest, you know, being like, oh, we'll just see if the test was working.
Always kismet, right? Kismet. Like it's just those.
And that's what's difficult when you're doing a feature film as well. It's so difficult to leave certain things on the edit room floor because you know, oh my God, it's cost, you know, £1,000 for that. And, you know, it's taken us 12 hours to shoot it, but it doesn't really progress the story. So we've got to cut it. And it's so difficult to do that at this level. I think it's a lot easier if you're, you know, conscious of how much effort and time people have put into
it. Well, this is the thing, because Jason's always very, like, he's very, like, no, just cut it. Don't be, you know, emotional and stuff like
You've got to be brutal,
But, yeah, absolutely. And I agree with him 100%. But I'm a little bit looking forward to the pain that he's going to go through when it's actually like, oh, I remember that we spent half a day on it.
It will be the Peter Jackson moment, okay? Because I've brought this up. We haven't done The Hobbit on our podcast yet, but we will do all of his stuff because I love that whole series. But the problem I had with The Hobbit, because he gives you all the behind-the-scenes stuff. I love directors who do that. And it's not just directors and film crews. Who
love that special edition DVD.
I am that guy that spends like 20 hours watching every last bit of it just to make sure I've understood what they did. But on the first one for The Hobbit, so the long unexpected journey. Obviously, they go in the goblin caves, and there's two scenes in the behind. One of which showing these lovely eight actors that are extras, but have learned to walk like a goblin. They've got that guy that is the Mr. Monster Mover guy that teaches them how to move like goblins, and they do a great job of it. And they're kind of sitting around a lot, and they're always joking around. So there's this whole skit on like these are the goblin people. And then they move on to the next chapter and Peter Jackson's like, so then I saw the CGI goblins and I liked them a lot better. So we just dismissed the entire crew and reshot the whole thing with CGI goblins. And
wastefulness.
I was like, how much did that fucking cost? Yeah. Like, are you out of your mind? Like you just spent a week with these guys that had fuck all to do anyway, because you were only using them for this one scene. You've dismissed them and then charged the VFX house to put a whole new thing in there. Like, if I was your producer, I'd fucking kill you.
Yes, that's all right. You're self-funding your movies, right?
Yeah, exactly.
What?
Exactly. So how you do the kind of the shorts, the 48-hour kind of thing. When do you decide, okay, like features the next step? Because we've been talking a lot about this and we want to take that step, but I'm just interested to know when you decided.
Well, I wasn't sure it was ever going to get there, if I'm honest, but we did a short film, I think it was 3 minutes long, for a competition, which was a BBC Three TV show called The Fear.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like a goggle box, but in a cinema, and it was short horror films, and they just wanted audience reactions. And they didn't end up actually showing ours on screen, so they used bits of it in the opening credits and the closing credits and stuff like this. And so what had happened was they ended up with we finished joint fifth basically with two other movies, But because of the way they wanted to edit and structure the program, they only wanted to show one movie at fifth because they didn't have the runtime to show more than the top five in the final episode.
Yeah.
And so rather than
flip of a coin kind of thing.
Yeah. Rather than get themselves in that quandary, they withdrew us from that, the screening element of it, which was a bit frustrating. So the prize for it was, I think it was £10,000 or something to make a feature film. And so that was kind of the impetus for doing it. And we got so far with that on a movie that we made for £200 that was, again, up against movies that were clearly, you know, more like £5,000, that it had actually been written as kind of a small segment from a larger story anyway. So we decided, while this process was going on, before we found out that it wasn't going to be shown, that we would develop it into a script, Matt and I, the writer. And we did that anyway. And we really wanted to make a folk horror because we felt like they were really underrepresented in the indie market in general. But there was a big appetite for them. Did that and just decided, look, let's have a go at the Kickstarter. And then that came off, and it was kind of like all the way along, we were like, oh, now we've got to do this. and it was...
Was this dogged? Sorry.
This
was dogged in 2017.
Like ridiculously ambitious. Like, I think there's like 22 principal cast members, and we were shooting at a location whose first quote was £6,000 for the day. And we ended up bringing it in for less than £20,000 for the whole movie. And just kind of then thought, well, what do we do now? Like, let's send it to some festivals and then started picking up awards and stuff. And we were like, okay, now what do we do?
Did you start going to festivals? Had you always had like a thing with festivals?
I'd kind of been to some before, but it wasn't a big thing, right? And part of that is because my life is so busy generally with everything else, is
work life,
family and all the rest of it. So my job kind of quite frequently, you know, used to take me away. I was abroad for a lot of the time. I'd done different bits in different places. I went to a couple when I was living in Los Angeles and things like that. But I randomly, representing a movie that I hadn't even worked on, went to the Bahamas for a day and a half because I was the director's assistant and they wanted someone there to represent the film. So they flew me to the Bahamas for a day and a half.
Well, you know.
Could be worse.
It's really random, right? Yeah.
So you lived in LA then,
did you? Yeah. So yeah, I was working as a personal assistant for a director, producer, writer, and I did like two long stints in LA, and I was Toronto, and then I was actually for about two years commuting to France. I was like two and a half years. To
France.
Holy yeah, crap. I to the south of France, like she was halfway between Cannes and Monaco in a little village called Villefranche-sur-Mer, which is where like Bono and Elton John and Mick Jagger live.
Yeah. Did you go to the boulangerie and like bump into fucking Keith?
It was sort of like I was just in this bloody office the whole time. Like it felt like I was there. It was kind of like we used to start at like 10 in the morning but work till 10 at night. And
And
I'm so boring as well. It was like I went to the same restaurant every single night when I lived there, and I had exactly the same meal every single time. It was like pasta. What was it I used to have? I can't even remember. Was it pasta with mushrooms and it was really bland, right?
I didn't take
advantage of it.
you know that there's like a waitress in that restaurant who still tells the tale.
Remember that ginger guy who had the same Englishman thing every night.
Who had the same bland spaghetti every fucking day. That's crazy, man. Okay. Go on, Jason.
No, I was just going to say, I think there's a lot to, you know, I'm absolutely loving this one, Richard, because there's a lot to unpack in what you're saying. One thing that strikes me that that I should have brought up probably about 20 minutes ago when you started is, man, you grind, you're a grinder. And like, we get so many people you know, people that call us after London Horror Society stuff, they'll pick up the phone and they'll say, I got this, I want to do this. And it's like, what do I do? And it's like, do it. Like, we'll help, you know, tell us what you want to do, or yeah, tell us to organize it. We'll put it together. But people sit for so long on things and they're like, I want to make a film. And it's like,
there is a lot,
get a damn camera, make a film then. I, you know, iPhone 10, perfectly good pictures, right? So
this is it now. Yeah, you can. You've got that facility on your phone to edit it and everything else and color it. I like to kid myself that if that technology had been around when I was 18, I would have got started a lot earlier as well. I don't know that I would, but
when we first started out, I tried to get Ed completely Linux based. And the only reason I was doing that, as I said, listen, we're indie, right? So I want to use software that anybody can use for free. I don't want to use the Apple stuff. Now, we moved everything onto the Apple stuff eventually.
God damn them.
You know, the idea was like, listen, if you are a 15-year-old kid and you've got a camera, you know, or an iPhone, you know, which your parents have bought.
I mean, you've got a smartphone and you've got a laptop.
Yeah, you know, download DaVinci and download this. Read the manuals, which are long and complicated and need time. That's why you're going to be 15 doing this. You know what I mean? But read them.
It's possible.
You'll be able to do what filmmakers do in a heartbeat. Yeah. It's easy. And so that's the thing that always gets me. I get it from my day job all the time. People always think there's some magic to this, that there's some sort of like trick that makes it work, that people make films. And I always have to explain, like, it's nothing like that at all. It's just work. Like, people,
it is hard graft, exactly what you say. And you know, it's, I think, you know, bless my wife and kids, I'm going to say this and she's going to hear, and hopefully, you know, not mine, but it's like,
points.
I spend so much time, yeah, like away from home. Like if I'm doing paid job, or if I'm, you know, I care for my mum as well at the moment, like full time. And it's like, doing the movies and doing the film festival that I'm running, it's like you just got to be on it the whole time if you want to progress, and you can't let up, unfortunately.
The other
important thing to remember, and Ed and I were kind of laughing about this earlier today. I called him 4 o'clock with a bit of a panicked speech about something, but we were laughing because, like, I will always be the family producer. Like, I, you know, I think the first time I had a production job, the person came over here and met my daughter because I had to, you know, I just needed her there, and I had to explain to people, like, they're always a part of my life. Now they are used to me having not hobbies, but things that I do that take me away from them. But like, I can't make a decision without thinking about them. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it factors into, and I run a production studio now, so they're pretty much part of the studio. You know what I mean? Like a very big factor on that. I think the funniest thing that ever happened with that, Richard, is a long time ago, you know, I think someone thought I was more well-versed as a producer than I was, and they made an offer that was nothing. You know, it was one of those, we want you to come over and work on this, it's going to be a lot of money, blah, blah, blah. And I went to my wife and I said, listen, I just had these guys blowing smoke up my whatever, you know, but it's a lot of money. And she's like, well, how much money were they talking? I said, it sounded like millions from what they were saying, because they wanted me to work on this series with them and do this thing. And she's like, and where do they want you to go? And I was like, well, they're out of LA, so they want me to, you know, fly over there and check it out. And she's like, how much are they going to pay you again? And I was like, I don't know. Sound like millions. She's like, well, for millions, you could buy an awful lot of plane tickets to California, you know? And I was like, okay, I get it. All right, yeah.
Can I ask, because I think a lot of people, myself included, and a lot of young people ask the question, did you feel that it was important for your career to make the move to LA? Was that something that, I mean, obviously you've got to talk about it with your girlfriend, wife, whatever, but.
Yeah, I mean, it was a difficult position. So basically the way that the woman that I was working for, she would go and we would shoot the movie somewhere. And then she would go essentially for the winter to Los Angeles to do the post-production.
Right.
Because she wanted to be in Los Angeles for the winter. And so I used to come home for Christmas and whatever, but it was just kind of Skyping every day and everything else. And it was a big consideration. We didn't have kids then. I don't think I could have done it if we did have kids. But yeah, I mean, we'd been together for years, obviously, but it, you know, that kind of helped as well, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it as an opportunity to go out there and try and meet as many people as I could, and
for sure
learn as much as I could. And I, you know, hopefully I used that. And I also got to do cool things like going to screenings at the, you know, Beverly Hills Theater and things
right,
like that.
Right. The Kodak Theater and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think a lot of, you know, a lot of people do wonder if it's, you know, the thing to do. I always tell people, if it's something that you want to do, go for it. It's not, but it's not for everyone, and it can like chew people up and spit them out. Like,
I always feel bad for you, Ed, because like you have my versions of LA, and I never was in LA as a filmmaker. I was out there with film people that knew my family because they worked with them in the past and different things, and so I hung out with Hollywood people, but I didn't do the film thing, and that's why for me, because I was trying to do something else out there when I was there, I get burnt out after about a year, and that's when I met you, went out to Korea, but. You know, the film scene there, Ed, does sound, you know, it's one of those things, guys. It's just like we always talk about Ed's filmmaking kind of hippie commune. Like, you're not going to go wrong going there and telling people you want to make films. And as long as, you know, dear listeners, as long as you listen to the kind of stuff that Richard was saying about, just don't get caught up in what everybody else is doing. I think you can go into LA and get people to help you with something you want to do and get involved and what other people.
There's a lot of creative people there. I mean,
exactly. Don't play keeping up with the Joneses there, because it'll eat you alive.
I think going there and spending that time there kind of demystified it, you know, a bit for me, because, you know, they're just normal people. Yeah, they're in the production capital of the world, but they're just normal people and they're living normal lives. And as you said, Jason, you know, a lot of them get burnt out very young from the kind of social side of things as well as. As well as the actual work as well. And that wasn't something that I ever wanted to be part of.
Was always like, I'm coming back. It's not like I'm going to test the waters, see what it's like. And then maybe
I do love it there. I absolutely do. But I don't feel like I would want to live there on a permanent basis. If I won the lottery, I'd buy a pad there. Right. But
yeah. It's so funny because we have that conversation. Yeah. Like, we have the conversation all the time.
No, I was just talking about it because she wants NoCal, and I'm like, I'm not going to have a second place because I'm making films now and I'm doing well in Northern California. It's going to have to be close to where I want to make films in SoCal. But I was like, but that's how it is for me. Because for me, Richard, like, the other weird thing is because I'm Midwestern. Like, I come from cold winters, hot summers. Yeah. I couldn't deal with that in LA. Like, I just could. I love the beach. Was there every day with my surfboard. But
I'd imagine it would get tiring.
It wasn't tiring. It was like, it's just what I love about England. Because England is like where I come from, but neutered. So you have like cold,
neutered,
hot summers, but they're never that cold. Although the people I live with, obviously, that's the best thing about living here is everybody acts like a little bit of snow. You know, like, we're all going to die. And then it gets hot out here. It gets like 60 degrees, what I would consider like mildly hot. And people are like, we're melting in the sun. I love it here. I'm like, it's perfect. It never gets too cold. It never gets too hot. It doesn't actually rain nearly as much as people think it does. Like, perfect. And that's why, like, when I got here, I was like, God, I'm gonna be here a long time, aren't I? Because, you know, like, LA, like, Christmas with palm trees, I couldn't do it. It was so weird.
So moving forward, like, you see yourself like, as you know, this is my base of operations, this is like, I want to get the industry kind of
I don't know that I've got a desire to kind of, you know, push the whole industry on, but, you know, I really like the filmmaking community that's here, and I think that there's just as good a work being made here as anywhere else in the world from the movies that I see at festivals all over the place. And, you know, it's, you know, don't get me wrong, I like dipping my toe in it by going to festivals in other countries or whatever, but you know, when you're,
that's kind the of, fun you know, way to do it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, I don't think you can kind of be, you know, if I wanted to set a movie in Louisiana or something and I needed to go over there to shoot, great, you know, it's kind of one thing, but filmmakers just telling the same old story over and over again, right, in just different formats. And the my story with most of those is, you know, the person who doesn't fit in to society around them. So I don't feel this need to kind of fit in anywhere else other than kind of where I am.
Love it. I love it.
So do you know who Michael Bisping is? He was the English champion for UFC for a while. And every time he talked about how he lived in England, it was awesome. He was never going to do it again. And then he flew himself and his family out to California for like his third fight out there. And all of a sudden, the next set of interviews were like, we just had to do it, mate. We just had to do it. It was warm sun and, you know, the white sun. And it was like, and all of a sudden you're like, Mike, you just spent three interviews on like, I'm never leaving England. Like, cause I don't know. Like, I think what happened with Mike is he won his second fight. So all of a sudden it was like, well, now I can't afford a home either place. So what does it matter? I want to be in England, you know, like.
I did want to ask about the festival thing, because you know, again, we've talked about, you know, how amazing the Fright Fest family is, and just the vibe that comes from that. And you know, I've enjoyed going to festivals in Busan, like for the International Film Festival there. I used to go every year, and it's a lot of fun. Like, can you talk about how you kind of started to get involved in festivals? And
I don't really remember, if I'm honest, but I know that some of them, the ones that you go to, you know, like you say with Fright Fest, you know, wherever you, like we I've been a couple of times now to Buffalo in New York.
Yeah.
And I really feel like part of the family there. Like, they kind of welcome you with open arms. And I think we've played,
I remember, yeah, Nefarious.
Four times now.
A lot of promotion for Nefarious over there when you played. What's the name of the festival?
Buffalo Dreams.
Yeah, that was it.
And so Greg and Chris that run it are just, you know, fantastic. And so Greg is the director of Slime City. You ever seen Slime City? It's like a punky kind of tromery kind of classic from the 80s, well worth a watch, and like one of my favorites from that kind of era. And so he's done loads of other movies as well. But they put on the short of Dogged. When we first played it, and it won Best Micro Short, which was, you know, nice. Kind of a big boost. And then literally the next year we were back there with the feature, and they played it as their closing night film, and we won Best Horror Feature, and we were kind of blown away. And then we've had Nefarious there. We had our world premiere of Nefarious there on opening night, playing straight after Isaac Esban's movie, which was like a big thrill. And then we were back there this year with Misconception, which is just a fun little short that we did in the meantime. And yeah, it's just, you know, Skip Shea, who runs Shauna Shea Film Festival up in Massachusetts as well. You know, you kind of become intrinsically linked with these people.
And, yeah, because they kind of discover you, right? Like, they're
exactly, they kind of
bet on you, right? So they want to promote.
Work with, she has a sheet, like, and I still have it because I use it for myself now for all the film. But it was like literally all the ones she knew that were. You know, if you did it was the Fright Fest circuit. It was like, if you were a Fright Fest person, all of these different festivals, not to say they would put you in, because God knows now I've gone through them and they definitely do say no if they don't like it. But
yeah,
they're definitely also places that will help you as filmmakers. Like, they reach out to
some, yes,
your film explained, right. You know, why the reasons were, people I could talk to, invite you out anyway. You know, the ones that do play you, make sure you get extra attention because you're coming from outside. Like, I think
really good that way. What you learn as well from kind of doing the festival circuit is that, you know, there are these wonderful festivals that I'm talking about, and then there's ones that are so heavily political.
I know
at the other end of the scale. And so I've had one with Dogged where, and it was a big festival, and they contacted me and they said, look, if you can cut half an hour out of your movie, we'll show it.
Yeah.
I'm like, cut half an hour out of my movie. I was like, I'm not doing that. I'm not cutting, you know, two characters and three subplots to fit into a 90-minute slot window when I've made a folk horror movie that's very deliberately paced.
Right.
And very deliberately long. That, and so kind of refused. And then we've had one where the and you know, this is kind of slightly different here, but one of the festival directors private messaged me the day before the notifications and said, look, we're really sorry, but your movie is literally the last one we've cut from the schedule because it was like a toss-up between yours and one other, and we felt we needed a homegrown filmmaker in there because we were kind of underrepresented. And so, you know, there's kind of a politicization that goes on with it in certain ways. And the one thing that does really irk me is when they have, like, the whole idea for me of film festivals is showing movies that people don't get to see anywhere else. Aren't going to get a big release. And the number of times I look at a program and you can tell, look, okay, so this particular distributor is sponsoring this festival and 10 of the features are from this distributor. Wow, shocking news. And it just kind of bothers me a little bit in that it's like those movies don't need the publicity, right?
I was lucky enough to, lucky enough is not how we describe it, but I got to do some interviews with the guys who pick films, right? Whose job it is to pick the films, the heads of a bunch of different festivals, including like Cannes and stuff like that. And yeah, a lot of them were like, yeah, there's you know, pressure from a sponsor And that's going to dictate what happens at the film festival, because yeah. it's about the money, you know, on a lot of them, which is why I love like the horror festival and that Jason kind of like, he said, dude, you got to come. I go every year. It's fucking amazing. And I was like, oh, I don't know. Like, and then I went and I had such a goddamn blast. Like,
yeah.
I feel like horror film festivals are in a league of their own.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because everybody's there with a common purpose, right? They've all got exactly the same interest. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, sometimes that can be a little bit hard on some of the filmmakers whose movies don't necessarily go across particularly well because mob mentality in there. But
it's the other thing I will have to get Ed used to, because it was like, I still remember watching, I think it wasn't Holliston. It was what he did after Holliston. Adam Green, being a guy I've always liked his movies, at least, never really met him personally. But so I go to his Q&As though, because I think, yeah, I want to listen to this guy, like how he makes a film at least. And he was doing it. It was the mockumentary that he did about like going and seeing the creatures and things like that. But there were a bunch of his hardcore fans were there. And they were asking about Holliston, which was this TV show that he'd done in America. It was a comedy. It had his best friend in it, one of his best friends, that was the lead singer of a band called Gwar, which is just an awesome band. If you've never heard of them, Google them after the show. And oh my God, like just their shows were the
best. I'm familiar just because the name is badass.
Mate, when I was a teenager, they had a cum cannon, maggot cum cannon that used to shoot out over the audience. Like you just can't pay for that kind of entertainment anymore. Like it was awesome. It was awesome. No, and they're all like, the best part is the guys that were in this band are all like geniuses from UVA. They're not like, you'd think they just couldn't like put two things together. Like
right. They're proper smart. From
University of Virginia. But one of them was a really good friend of Adam Green's, and he was on the show and then he passed away. And so like the fan, and I say the fan, and this is why I remember this, because only a fan, like a super fan, would say something like this. The fan asked him, after he tells us that he's just divorced his wife and he's not going through a great time, I ended up buying him a drink that night, if I remember correctly. You know, I was like, that sucks, man. Then the person stands up and asks and says, so are you going to replace your best friend on Holliston or what? Like, is there going to be a new character? And it just was like, what? Like, I mean, this dude looked like he's about to cry. It's Adam Green. And you're like, oh, man, I wouldn't ask that right now.
Jason's quite a magnet for like directors with horror stories, like actual horror stories. Like he was telling me once about the guy who like had mortgaged his house, the Brazilian guy.
The Brazilian guy, right? Because I wanted to work with him. I wanted to make a film with him because this is horrible. And I'm not that Latino, but South America is a place in my day job I did a lot of business in. And so I know the area well. I love the people down there. And this guy came over from Brazil with Mal Noso. So it was the film that was like 2 years ago. It was decent. Really enjoyed it. But then we had like the Q&A. And the first thing I said was like, the film was a bit too long. Like there just wasn't enough cut out of it. So I wondered, who did he produce this with? Who did he work with? Because there's all these middling scenes that I was like, they should have been cut out of there because they didn't have anything to do with anything. And then
to be fair with him, this was before he became like an artiste and started directing and stuff.
All right, man. So that guy had like his dad and the clown outfit, and it completely came out of left field. And the rest of the film is great, but then we're talking about the clown outfit. I'm like, the hell are we doing here? You know? So no, I always would have kicked that, but it was fine. I was like, I'm going to talk to this guy afterwards to see if he wants to do a project or something together. And then he was talking. And he was like, and it was like, well, how did you raise the money for this $300,000 film? He's like, oh, I sold my house. And immediately I picked up the phone to Ed, like, never mind. Like, funny enough, nowadays, because I'm a big fan of Benson and Moorhead, and they had to mortgage their house for the third film they did, Spring.
Okay.
And so now I'm more lenient on what the
world. Yeah, you can find examples, you know, Kevin Smith for the credit cards and stuff like that. But okay, so what about the current film that you're kind of in the midst of working? I'm interested to hear a little bit about that.
So yeah, so it's called Mask of the Devil, and it's kind of quite a departure from the ones we've done in the past. So the script is very kind of self-referential. So it's about a filmmaker who has had a couple of successful movies, but in order to try and kind of finance and progress, he's kind of dipped off into the world of kind of low budget porn to
okay
to make ends meet.
This all sounds like a documentary to me.
Yeah. I was going to say, yeah, we've all had that moment, right, where we're like,
if nothing else,
money for this film.
and so the protagonist is a kind of a young girl called Mary, and she is having a bad time at home, and kind of sees this opportunity to go and get a job at this low budget porn company. And goes to set, and at the same time the production designer from the movie has bought some props because they're making a parody of Tarzan, and she's bought this mask, which is turns out to be an actual authentic West African cursed mask. When people put it on, it kind of takes them over and unleashes this evil spirit in the form of a slasher movie. And so it's basically all of these people trapped in a porn set being hunted down. it's got like an 80s kind of vibe and aesthetic.
You know that we love it.
Yeah.
You know
I mean? Yeah. That's we're all over that
one. It was like, oh my God, synth the hell out of this. This is
awesome. Yeah.
it's a lot of fun. So we've shot 5 days so far. We've got about 15 more days to go. We're having to kind of break up the shoot a little bit because we're not really allowed more than 4 actors on set with masks off at a time at the moment.
Life as a filmmaker during the Rona, is it the nightmare that I imagine it is?
Do you know what? It's not anywhere near as bad as kind of it could be. I mean, we were advised to keep less than 10 crew on set. And less than 4 actors without masks on at any one time, obviously, to kind of restrict stuff. So everybody has to do a lateral flow test every morning and report it. And then we have to take temperatures twice a day, thankfully on foreheads.
Not rectally.
I want you to suffer. My wife is teaching, and it's like... It's like I'm sure conservative government is just like, yeah, this is great. Let's do it every day.
So everybody has to sign a COVID confirmation every day as well, saying that they've had no symptoms and not been in contact with it. It's kind of all fairly boring and mundane stuff, but you know, perfectly happy to kind of adhere to that in order to protect everybody's safety.
Yeah, I don't know, because everybody reads the Tom Cruise story, right? And I just can't picture most sets being like that. You know, Tom Cruise obviously is going to get mad if somebody's not doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Most of the kind of big professional stuff that we're working on with my work as well, you know, you have to get tested 2 or 3 times a week and wear the masks all the time and everything else. So kind of everybody's doing it, but it's just different scales of it, right? So we have to give everybody a lateral flow test in their car when they arrive in the morning, and they have to sit in the car for half an hour rather than queuing up, you know, to get a nurse to do it or whatever. But it was tricky the first couple of days, but you know, you fall into it really quickly.
Now you're in the groove.
Yeah, exactly. It's not really a problem. And it's kind of, it costs us a little bit more in catering because we can't do catering. You can do individually wrapped craft services stuff, but you can't have kind of, you know, buffet style food. So, you know, it bumps the cost of catering up by a couple of pounds a head every day or whatever, but it's not the end of the world.
Right.
Yeah.
And what is the kind of end date, do you think, that it'll be ready to
hit
the festival's route?
We've got a couple of really big ensemble scenes. So the prologue of the movie is set in 1880s Africa, and there's kind of this big tribal fight that goes on with these British explorers. So that's going to be a bit challenging because we've got like 25 people or something in that day just in the cast, so that'll be pushed. We're probably looking at like September time for that, but we're kind of editing as we go and everything, so hopefully by the following year the kind of Halloween season for the festivals is kind of the big one, right? They start from sort of September onwards, and so hopefully we'll be ready for that in 2022, fingers crossed.
What about with Nefarious and Misconception? Now, Misconception, is that done with its festival run now, or can people still catch that somewhere?
No, that's playing. Quite a lot of the festivals rolled over last year's editions, and they're doing double length ones next year. So, yeah, we've still got some coming up for that. I think we're playing, we're going to be playing in Boston and Austin for sure. And we played back in February. We were at Horrible Imaginings in San Diego, which was online with Miguel Rodriguez, which is a great festival. Mm-hmm. And we've done Nightmares and kind of a few others with it. So that's kind of still on the go. But that was kind of, it's not like a proper horror, right? It's kind of done as a kind of a gross out gag horror comedy.
I was intrigued when I read it. I was like, oh, this could be quite dark, but yeah, there is a punchline kind of
effect. Exactly, to it, right. There? Yeah, that's it. I mean, it was kind of all originally conceived around that gag as well and conceived.
I do love that about shorts, though. I have to say that's like some of my favorite type of writing. It's just the punchline writing. Like, maybe it's because it's so easy. No, I wouldn't say easy. It's so quick. Like, when you come up with the idea, you're like, bam, we could do it. Like,
well, it's sketch, you know. Like, I don't know if you've ever watched Key and Peele, Richard, but they do some great, like, cinematic little short gags, essentially, it went in their show. And yeah, I really enjoy stuff like that. And so what is the festival that you were just helping organize?
So it's not a horror one, funnily enough. It's called Fisheye mm-hmm. Film Festival. It's based out of Wickham, and it's the whole idea of the Fisheye Film Festival is that you're kind of seeing the bigger picture. So you have everything from really, really gross horror movies to kind of, you know, an uplifting kind of family drama about a boy and his dog made by a 15-year-old director, which is remarkable.
That's kind of I love stuff like that.
Everything in between, you know. And so we had a genre block on the Friday night, which was kind of sci-fi and horror stuff. And they played really well with the kind of prize jury as well. They took a lot of the awards. But yeah, so that was something I've been doing for, I think, 4 years now.
Fisheye Festival.
Has been, you know, the fact that you don't do just horror talking about this, like it's often the misconception we can get from listeners and some people that come to us for production advice and stuff like that is that, oh, I'll only do genre. And it's like, I mean, I don't know. I don't write just horror. I can't. Like I write about what I want to write about and there's no way I'm just going to stick to horror because so many better concepts out there. However, what I'm always telling people is, but if I want to make it as a filmmaker, I know that's the kind of the shortest path. The other ones I could write is Christian movies. So in America, if I wrote Christian movies, you know, you can rise up the ranks doing that. And I'm like,
and you can get funding for those as well, right?
Yeah, dude, my parents are uber Christian, so I'm like, I could get the money.
Hold on, I gotta tell the story of the thread. So he gets, oh, this was so fucking funny. He, like, every other night I get a text message at about like 1 a.m. like, oh, I've had an amazing idea. Here's the pitch, right? And there's a whole message. And then often the next day, like, we don't even talk about it. Like, but on this one occasion, I don't know what it was, but we were talking about like Christian movies and stuff like that. And he goes, dude, I could write like 50 fucking Christian movies that would be a huge, and he just starts throwing like names. And they were so ridiculously funny that I ended up wetting myself with laughter in a cafe surrounded by a bunch of people.
I don't remember from that anymore. It was the Vatican is down. I'm like, I'll do Olympus Has Fallen, but we're gonna do it with the Vatican. It's gonna be awesome. Like, thanks, rolling in.
What was the one with Job?
It's at the Vatican, but the Pope won't go down. That's not how he does.
So funny.
Well, I tell you, because before I did the film thing, like there's this big hiatus where I'm not a creative because I'm pursuing a legal and insurance career. Like, surprise, surprise, guys. Like, I just did the white collar thing because it paid the bills. But before that, I was a musician, right? And the easiest way as a punk musician to get up, if you were willing to do it, and I never was to go with the Christian labels. Tooth and Nail was one of the biggest ones. And they funded the hell out of some really good bands because they decided their first couple albums would be clean and they wouldn't, you know, a lot of those guys were the straight edgers. So the punk rockers who didn't do drugs, alcohol, and everything else, never really got along with them. But you know what I'm saying? Like, you know what I mean? Like, this was how they did it. It was like, but dude, now I'm a musician. Now I get to tour. Blah, blah, blah. And it made perfect sense. You're like, okay, well, if it's really your dream, the music's more important than the lifestyle, then you definitely would do this. So, you know,
so
I guess my point is, like, be a filmmaker, live in lots of different worlds, but horror is always, has always been, I guess, the way to get there the quickest. You know what I mean?
Sure. I mean, I couldn't see myself making anything other than kind of horror and sci-fi, but that doesn't mean I don't love you know,
kind other of films, movies. The Godfather and stuff like that.
I don't love The Godfather, but
that's fair enough. That was just an example.
I get crucified for that whenever I say it. People are like, yeah. "Oh, I can't believe you don't love The Godfather."
No. Like I'm so not a judgy person when it comes to that. In fact, one of my biggest pet peeves is when you say, "Oh, I've never seen that," and someone goes, "Oh my god, I can't believe you!" It's like, "All right, relax. Like, you know, sell it to me." Like, convince me that I should watch it rather than being a prick about it.
Ed, you're perfect for that because, you know, Godfather is one of my favorites. It's probably my favorite film. But then you watch it with Ed and Ed will be like, did you see how they did the shadows in that? Wasn't it awesome? I'm like, what shadows? What? And then you go back and watch it and it's like, wow, that's a masterclass.
Overanalyzing. Once you get into this shit, like, I don't know how it was for you because you've been in it like a long time. But for me, I used to watch movies one way. And now I watch them a totally different way.
I think it's a difficult one. I think whenever you've kind of studied film techniques, then you do kind of perhaps notice them a bit more. And I think if you work in particular departments as well, you like if the greenery is bad or something.
Yeah, okay.
Oh my god, sorry, because I was
down. What's the most egregious?
He's a greensman? I'm like, I know, it's so cool, right?
I don't know. It never bothered me when I was, you know, 8 years old and I watched it. But one of my favorite movies is Predator.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the greenery in it is horrendous.
And that's in a fucking jungle. Really bad.
Yeah, right. So there's bits where obviously the jungle was like not quite interesting enough for them. So they just cut leaves off palm trees and then just jab them in like one at a time, like in the background. And it's just... It's oh my so God, awful. I love this.
And do you ever critique when you've kind of done something for a director and you're like, oh, he shot it wrong. He should have shot it differently.
Not really. A lot of the kind of big stuff that we do is so heavily pre-visualized.
Right.
In advance,
so they know exactly what color the fucking tulip is. And stuff
There's no kind of spontaneity to it at all.
Yeah, would you say these days with sums involved, that's just how it has to be? Like, you know what I mean?
I think it has to be. Yeah, absolutely. I think it, especially anything. I mean, obviously, like everything big end now has got, you know, a level of VFX in it, and they can't afford to have to do that in a way that they don't want to do. So everything, you know, all of the physical action has to be there spot on so that they can match it up with what they've kind of, you know, pre-visualized on the VFX front.
Absolutely.
And do you then feel that, like, you know, kind of jumping between the big projects and, like, you know, your kind of micro budget stuff, do you feel that it's a very different muscle that you're exerting, that there's actually, like, it keeps you sane to do that stuff rather than repetitively just, you know, color by numbers kind of thing?
I think it just kind of reasserts the fact that, you know, I go on these sets who have stationary budgets that are five times what we're making feature films for. And you know, you walk into this stationery cupboard that's like the size of my living room, and you know, you're just thinking, wow, if they had a few less pens, I could make another movie, you know?
right.
So, oh yeah, my god.
It kind of it really helps
shareholders, you know.
Wow, that's amazing. Five times just on stationery.
Yeah.
I mean, Jason's always like, why are they so expensive?
That's part of my education is because I come from a, you know, my day job's at large corporates, you know, and the people I buy insurance for or help buy insurance are enormous corporates. So I have that. I know what that's like to be working on the big stage like that and to have the sums be eye watering when you see them and things like that. But I didn't always understand from a production, you know, aspect how that's controlled, right? And how that's looked at. And that's where I've kind of had to do a lot of reading, because it's like, you know, these are the people at Columbia Law that are putting, or not Columbia, Columbia Film School that are putting out the books and saying, this is how we do it. And it does make sense. Like, you know, again, when you start getting these categories of sums, you know, you're talking about some very serious investors and some very bad consequences, I guess, is the point, if things go wrong. And that's why, you know, we've done podcasts on that. I think one of the best podcasts we ever did was talking about Why Transcendence, which was 136 million, you know, budget film that makes 138 is a failure because, you know, the investors behind that at and I can't remember if it was Warner Brothers or where it was, won't be happy with that kind of return because they will have shelled out 136 million for a film. Like they need to make some money back on that. You know what I mean? Yeah. Much more than what they had. So what we did in that one was kind of dissect where the issues were and where maybe some of the spend went the wrong way.
And we also compared it to like one of our favorite films.
I did that for you, Eddie.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for setting up. That's how we roll, which was Ex Machina, which you worked on.
Yep. Did the greens on that as well. Yeah. I mean, they're, it's so funny with these because they, you know, they'll go from greens is such a weird element of kind of a movie because art department don't really want anything to do it. And they kind of try and push it to construction and construction definitely don't want anything to do it. So they kind of try and bat it to set deck and set deck are kind of like, this is what we need. Can you just sort it out? Like they're really not interested. So it's kind of almost an independent department a lot of the time, but it's another thing with budgeting, like that they don't think, you know, they might have a scene in a jungle but they don't budget for making a jungle
like, right,
you can make a jungle for £10,000, right? And we're like not really. You know, you can do one shot maybe but
one angle. So
it's a funny one. And I think generally just sort of what you're saying there, Jason, is like for me, like I'm a really idealistic kind of filmmaker in that I really believe it's an art form. And I think that the business side of it is far too influential. I mean, I don't get me wrong. There's a place for $500 million movies. I would much rather see 50, you know, $10 million movies be made. And given the same backing in terms of publicity and advertising and cinema space, you know, I'm a big Star Wars fan, but you know, you go when Star Wars is released and you go to the 10 screen multiplex and it's playing on all 10 screens, that's not necessary to have it starting every 10 minutes.
No, right. That's what
that's a very good point. Very good
point. Put it on 2-3 screens, free up those other 6 or 7 or 8 screens for you know,
dude, you don't understand. I work at a theater which has a couple of cinema screens. And like whenever we ask, hey, can we have like Spider-Man or something like that? Like Disney's notorious for this. They're like, okay, but it's got to be playing on both of your screens every single slot for 2 weeks. And we're like, we can't do that. Like there's not enough people to come to this place. And they're like, well, we don't care.
So I do feel that.
Like
part of the problem is the way they set up with only two real models, you know, at least in the big business world. You know, you've got, you know, major studios will say we can make it out of LA that style where we're going to chunk some money at it. Or if you want to make a more independent version, a more artsy version, you got to go to Europe and use the country funds there. And there's like never a thought for the in-between being like, well, what if...
Yeah.
First of all,
the middle class, man. I think the middle class is dead.
Micro budget features are where they're at. Not because they're going to be the most quality you've ever seen, but that's where James Gunn comes from. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I did a whole thing on the MCU, and God, I won't get into it now. But you know, when I dove into
because we love Disney. Like we're total. I'm a Star Wars fanboy. I don't know if you've watched.
They farm their talent from
indie. I don't know if you guys have watched Bad Batch came out today, the new animated series. Fucking awesome. I'm just shill for Disney. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think there really is a place for them, but it's, you know, it is frustrating that, you know, particularly those, you know, $5 to $20 million movies just have disappeared out of the window. And it doesn't so many filmmakers think, oh yeah, it'll be my dream to direct Iron Man 4 or whatever. But the reality is when you get onto the set of Iron Man 4, you have zero creative input into that movie.
That look at Edgar Wright, right? Like he bowed out. Like he was like, this is, I love this shit. I grew up with this shit, but this is not for me.
Yeah.
This is not how I make films. And, you know, again, we've talked a lot about this shit, but it is something that, especially now, right? Like with what happened to COVID and the fact that a lot of cinemas are probably going to die.
yeah.
if we don't do something about it, you know?
I think they need to adopt a completely different model, like you're saying, Jason. I think that they need to move out of city centres. I think they need to be, you know, four or five screens, and I think they need to have four or five different movies on those screens.
Listen, when I lived in California, because I lived in Newport Beach, right? So I was down, I was more in Orange County, and I used to drive all the way down to Irvine to go to the indie theater that was there because they always played the best stuff. And I
what's the one that you took me to for the one in Shoreditch? So good.
Oh, Electric Six Cinema. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so cool. I love shit like that. Like, oh.
But on an even smaller scale here, like, so we have, you know, I don't know, you've probably got them near where you are as well, like local cooperative film societies.
But that's where Ed works at the Stag. So he works at like the local
Seven Oaks,
cinema. I love that because that's community. Like that's what everybody, you know, not getting too much.
And the film club as well. You've come to the film club, haven't you, Jason? Like to watch
with the Flea Pit, right? Or the Peach
Pit? Yeah, the Flea Pit. Like the Peach Pit is from 90210.
I know.
Flea Pit, right? Which is a cinema in a village that they do in a village hall. And like, every fucking Friday night it would be packed. One of the problems though is that like it's a generational thing, like everyone's 70 and above, right? So there's no young people kind of taking over, and I worry that that's going to die as well, because they do shit like the, you know, Aguirre, the Wrath of God, they do like Vim Vendors,
the Slough one we have here, I saw, you know, discovered so many movies that really should have had a theatrical release that didn't, like Moonlight. I saw
right?
You know, and Let the Right One In.
Yeah.
And movies like that, you know, and you go along kind of, you know, not knowing much about them, but seeing them on a big screen, like you say, though, I think it is a generational thing and it's difficult.
But I hear what you're saying. The problem is the business model, like you said. You know, with a company like Disney or with like Time Warner, like they have shareholders. And the other thing that people don't always understand, and I've been talking to Ed about this with Netflix, like they have a business model that doesn't rely on film. You know, Sony is another good example of that. Sony can take a bunch of bombs in their films. As long as they're big budget and one of them makes a couple hundred million, it'll fit in perfectly for their budget for the rest of the year with everything else. Like, I don't know that personally. It's not like I work for Sony. It's just, that's how the business model is going to work. Disney's
right.
example, because they make most of their money from what I know, you know, from people going to Disney World. You know what I mean? That's their big cash cow. And that's why they were dying in COVID. But movie wise, like Disney Plus will make them a bit because they've got subscriptions and they're pouring money into that for talent reasons.
The Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, right? Like that's probably why they bought Star Wars, you know, just to put it in their theme parks.
So you look to the only person out there that's really funding maybe not even low budget, but mid budget stuff.
Medium,
kind of going out there, and it's Netflix. And I don't know where their return is because they don't have any theaters. And so it's like, do you make more money? If you give theatrical releases to this, are you going to make money back that way? Like, what are they banking on?
Yeah.
And so I just wonder, because it's like that model, the subscription model, the problem is like, it just doesn't have enough variables. Like
you introduced me a lot to like the A24 stuff, like, you know, those kind of, and they've, what a great job they've done of like, just aiming for that demographic and being like, we can make money from priced films.
I'm hoping that Arrow Video becomes a little bit more than that, hopefully. Like no one has told me that they're trying to do this, but if I was sitting with them in a business meeting, I would say they have done an amazing job of picking up distribution in England for a lot of, England and Scotland, you know, and the rest of the UK, for picking up local talent and putting them out there, or picking up stuff that we're catching and putting it out there. But for me, next step for them would be make some of your own films. You know what I mean? Put it in there, because that's how A24 starts making some really quality stuff. They buy out distribution for other films that can't get it, and then start picking up those directors and saying, how about you make films for us? You know, we'll do it that way. So fingers crossed.
I think Blumhouse as well, you know, kind of topping out at 5 million in budgets, you know, that they've got a similar model, right? They're happy to make 20 movies because they know one of them's going to recoup the losses from the other 19.
Right. Cool, right? Makes sense.
You know, Jason sat down and it was that simple. And that's what I don't get. I don't always understand why that's not happening in other places in LA. Like that's a model that could be replicated in a lot of different places. And he's the only one that seems to be confident on it. And so I don't know. You know, that's why you read Variety and the Hollywood Reporter and all that to see where trends are changing. But I'm with you, Richard, that, you know, you're losing the art by not having the stories told. And it doesn't it doesn't hurt the big films to show the small films. It's more the other way around. You know what I mean?
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
I totally feel like we're just draining you right now because it's 20 past 10.
No, we are.
I'm so sorry. I won't ask. I was just curious because we watched Run, Hide, Fight, and I was curious if you'd seen it and what you thought. But
I haven't seen it, I'm afraid. This is another thing. Like, so I have so little time
to watch. You don't watch films anymore.
And it is like so many of these things that I work on as well. Like, I never see it. Like, and you know, then I don't even tell my friends or whatever, and they find out that I've done the greens or something. They're like, "Oh my god, it's amazing! Why didn't you tell me?" It's like, because I don't even like a lot of these things that we do for Netflix. Like, never even end up getting put on Netflix.
Right.
They just, you know.
Yeah. You're just doing the work, and yeah.
I mean, there's exceptions. Like, so 2 years ago, I was lucky. I went out to Jordan for a couple of months, and it was the HOD Greensman on Denis Villeneuve's new movie of June. I'm so psyched to see that because I was such a massive fan of it as a kid, like the Lynch movie and the books. But you know, stuff like that, I will totally go all out for. But IMDb has probably got like a quarter of the credits of the stuff that I've worked on. I'm just like, I can't even keep up with it anymore. You know what I mean? It's just like,
That's a nice problem to have. I'll be honest with you. If you ever need relief, I mean, I know nothing about plants. I kill most plants, but happy to pretend to look like you if you've gained like a lot of weight really suddenly.
Honestly, like I'm doing stuff and they're phoning me up at the moment and they're like, "Oh, it's like series two of such and such. Have you seen the first series?" I'm like, "I've never even heard of it." Like,
well, that's a lot of we were talking a lot about like just Netflix just seems to be pouring out, you know, content. And
I think they've given up on the quality of it.
It does seem like the quality control isn't quite there anymore. They're chasing Stranger Things, like, and you can't capture lightning in a bottle like that.
They're spending huge amounts of money on things, certain things, which I won't name the names on, that I know for a fact have had greens budgets of like £200,000 upwards that are on their homepage for 3 days and then just buried. No.
Yeah, I mean, this was my concern. Like, the first time it happened, and again, it's the businessman in me, right, Richard, like, was The Irishman. It was like, we've done this, paid all this money, you know, for this film. And I was like, okay, I'll watch it. I watched it. I fell asleep to it twice, went through it, thought it was a good film. You know, doesn't win awards, but is nominated for a bunch of awards.
Then
the business side of me is like, so what did you get out of all that? Other than Martin Scorsese loves you now because you're...
Right.
No other studio was willing to put up the money for. Fine. So Martin Scorsese will come back and make a new film for you. But what does that mean? To be fair, every time I see them putting out films, like the Russo brothers film that just came out, it was okay. The Russo brothers are like some of my favorite directors, like big Marvel.
Is this the Ransom?
Yeah, and it was good, but it's forgettable. It's not.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not Winter Soldier.
I really like it.
It's like, why? Completely. You know, directors are going to walk away from that at a certain point when they figure out that they are just one of a thousand titles that people are going to click through and disregard. You know what I mean?
I imagine you probably watch a lot more like cartoons with your daughter and like your kids.
I end up watching Teen Titans like on repeat, like endlessly.
You two need to have a beer at some point.
So disappointed at the movie. Went to the movie. He was like, dude, the show is so much better than this.
I haven't seen. So this is the thing. So like the first three or four times I saw the show, like as in the first three or four repeats of times I saw the whole five seasons.
Yeah.
It was entertaining and that now I'm a little bit tired of it now, but my eldest one's just started kind of getting into anime stuff. They've been watching some of that. So I don't know. It's weird viewing habits. Like when I'm watching TV, they're in bed or vice versa. There's not a lot. I go through a little binge. Like if I ever have like 2 weeks where I know I've got nothing to do, I have this cupboard here next to me, which is like 4 foot by 4 foot, and it's full of DVDs that I've been buying for the last 15 years and never got to watching.
Jason literally just did a cull of his collection. of like just stuff that
you've got to just get rid of it sometimes. I'm working my way through.
I just don't, you know what I mean? Work, you know, again, like, and thank you so much for all your time, Richard.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rich.
We are dragging you out with this one, and it's just because, like, you, for what we do on this show, the whole point is indie filmmakers listen, or other filmmakers or filmmaker fans listen, and it's like, what should we do if we want to go out there and make a film? And like, all I could say for this particular episode is listen to Richard. Like,
yes,
you are a worker, man. You have grinded at it. And like, you know, I only say the way I've had success in my other career, you know what I mean? It wasn't from having magic or talent or anything like that. It was just because I worked hard. You know, yeah. It's the same thing it sounds like from you. And that's how you can tell, because you go to watch a DVD collection. I still got some in the shrink wrap, you know what I mean? Because I really want to watch the film, but you got to do other stuff first. You know what I mean? Yeah. There's always, and when you're a family man, that's triply so, you know what I mean? Yeah. So
that's why I have no children, so that I can watch shit on.
Well, otherwise, how else would I find out about the new shows? You know what I mean?
That's like, true. That's true. Without me, he wouldn't know, like,
helping everyone
what's been released. Well,
so Matt, who I write with, who's a producer as well and production manager for us, is, he doesn't have kids as well, and he's always saying to me, have you seen so-and-so? I'm like, no. And then like, he's like, are you gonna watch it? I was like, I'm not gonna have time. Why don't you just tell me about the whole series? Yeah.
So we have those conversations
so he'll go through it. So Lovecraft Country was one he was telling me about the other day. He was like, yeah, it's okay, but you know. And I'm quite happy to just live vicariously through him and his TV watching habits.
The great thing is that because we do the podcast, this forces us to watch stuff. You know, and I really appreciate it, because I often forget, man, like when I'm, you know, when you're like in the midst of a project and it's so all encompassing, like you're giving like 100% of everything that you've got, right? And you forget that you were originally inspired by watching these things and seeing a story and you know, like just letting yourself be, letting yourself go with it, you know. And like I say, it's just one of the sad things when you become a little bit more analytical, but you can still sit down and enjoy like a good film. What did I watch
is one of the reasons why I think cinema is so important as well, you know, because I think you can go and you can completely cut yourself off and isolate from everything going on around you. Whereas if you're at home, you can sit down to watch it, your phone might go, or the cat jumps in your lap, or, you know, whatever but you're there, you're in the zone.
I completely agree. I mean, one of the first things I did when I picked up the production job and said I wanted to be a producer was pick up a cinema pass, like, because I hadn't been going. Like, I watched everything at home on TV, and it was like, no, like, you need to know what this looks like, what this feels like when you go back in, because you used to love it. And now, like, I was so miffed when we had lockdown twice, because that was my thing. Is like, it's, I don't get
every
out
every man pass.
I can always get out to the cinema because I have a cinema pass once a week to go see something cool. And the first thing you noticed was when the film started drying up. I'm telling you, man, like going to Cineworld and being like, I'm gonna see American Pickle for the third time because there's nothing else to play. You know what I mean? Like,
we were lucky that we were like, because the cinema industry was trying to help like the independent cinemas out and stuff. So they gave us like catalog stuff. They gave us like Star Wars Empire Strikes Back, because it was like the 40th anniversary. Fucking amazing, dude. Seeing that on a big screen again, I felt like a child. It was beautiful.
All right, my good man. Well, we are now at an hour and a half, and I won't take you because we've actually been talking for two hours.
I told you. I did warn you that I talk.
I don't mind at all. Trust us. Like, if you want to know how hardcore we can get, go to the Lovecraft and Watchmen podcast, which the Lovecraft one was a second recording of a 2.5-hour podcast when we had literally done it before and forgot to hit
the button. I fucked the sound up. I'll take the L.
Shut up. And as you can tell, like, I just love film. Like, and I'm coming to it late in life, so I always feel like I have so much to say about it, right? When I probably don't. But really awesome having you on the show, man. Like,
yeah,
this
dude
is one of the best ones we've done, because I really feel like everybody can listen to this, can watch this and understand, like, that's what you need to be doing. Like, if you want to make film, just go out there and do it. Don't worry about, you know, oh my God, this guy's done this, or this is going on, or I'm working on this. Just get out there and do it. So thank you so much for that, Richard.
No problem. It's been a pleasure chatting to you guys. Thank you.
You too, my good man. As I said, keep us posted with Mask of the Devil. We're always helping jump in if you need us. And
is there anything else you want to shout out as well? Like,
that's right. Before we close out the show, anything else, any shout outs to do?
just to my amazing cast and crew that have worked on all the movies, actually, because they've been, you know, steadfastly wonderful throughout, and their enthusiasm spurs me on at times when I don't think I can go on. So thank you to everybody.
We didn't get Films. Yeah, Ash Mountain, that's right, on YouTube as well, right?
That's our gang, yeah, and I love them all. Very
cool. Excellent.
Ash Mountain, our fellow brethren.